When it comes to the war on Syria, the role of the U.S. has been in question, from its fight against Daesh terrorists to its role in the wider war, to its support of the Kurdish militants in the context of Turkey. According to Russia, the U.S. is undermining the Syrian government by aiming to create a quasi-state. We ask, what is that exactly? Furthermore, we will ask how it is that the U.S. wants Iran out of Syria when it is there by the request of the Syrian government, while the U.S. is not.
The U.S. military presence in Syria has been marred by controversy ever since Washington began its operation inside the Arab country back in 2014. The U.S., which has been present in the war-torn country without any authorization either from Damascus or the UN, has repeatedly been accused of targeting and killing civilians. There is also an increasing risk of unpredictable escalations in Syria as American forces continue to target the Syrian army or their allied units, which are fighting terrorists and militant groups across the country. Over the past week, the U.S. military has carried out two attacks on pro-government targets in the province of Deir ez-Zor, killing scores of people. Some experts believe what Washington is plotting is an attempt to weaken Damascus and destabilize the country.
The United States, over the last couple of months, is very clearly trying to set up a Kurdish-led, U.S.-dominated statelet in northern Syria as part of a continuing campaign by the United States to destabilize the Syrian government and to partition Syria.
Syrian Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad says the U.S. is trying to prolong the war, calling on the U.N. to investigate Washington's illegal presence in Syria and its violation of the country's sovereignty. Iran's senior advisor to the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ali Akbar Velayati, has also called on the U.S. and those present in Syria without the permission of Damascus to leave. His call came after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned of a possible U.S. plan to continue its military presence in Syria for a long term.
Americans, I think, instead of diligently creating a united consensus, are trying to act through dangerous unilateral steps. And those steps look increasingly as part of efforts to create a quasi-state on a large part of the Syrian territory, from the eastern bank of the Euphrates River all the way to the border with Iraq.
Moscow and Washington support opposing sides in the Syrian conflict. Russia assists the Syrian government in their fight against terrorists. The U.S., however, which claims to be fighting the Daesh terror group, not only has been largely incapable of achieving its declared goal, but also has been repeatedly accused of trying to hamper Syria's full victory against terrorists through funding or arming militant and terror groups there. Now, as the Syrian army has gained momentum over terrorists across the country, the question is what would the U.S. plans be in the future after the years-long war ends?
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Adam Gary, who is the founder and director of Eurasia Future, joining us from London, and also Frederick Peterson, U.S. Congressional Defense Policy Advisor, joins us from New York. I'd like to welcome you both. And Frederick Peterson, let me first start with you. So you have the U.S. Secretary of State that is asking Iran to leave Syria, but Iran is there by the invitation of the Syrian government, and the U.S. is not.
Well, yes, that is true. And yet the motives of Iran are not necessarily those legitimately of the Syrian government or of the best interests of the Syrian people.
I
should say that we are fighting a common war here in, I beg your pardon, sir?
And the U.S. intention is?
We are fighting a common war, and even with, I beg your pardon? I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
What
Go
was
ahead.
That? No, that's quite all right. The irony of this is that we are all, the Russians, the Syrians, government, the Iranians, and the United States are fighting a common enemy there. There should be much more common cause in fighting that enemy. But that enemy is largely defeated now, at least it is greatly mitigated in its threat. And the real reasons why others are there including oil and gas production, including territorial expansion and regional hegemony, are coming to the fore now in place of the common battlefield objective of defeating a terrorist organization. And this is what, and there are also, as we know, Syria is an amalgam of many different peoples, and it has been patched together in colonial times by European powers. And the ethnicities that are gathered together, this is fine so long as they are peaceful and not predatory upon one another.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What has happened is the Kurds.
Let me bring in Adam Gary to get a response to you. Adam,
yes,
Gary, I started the question with what the U.S. has said. I'm going to quote what Rex Tillerson actually said. Amongst other things, he said, this again illustrates why Iran's presence in Syria is only destabilizing to the region. This comes after this alleged Iranian drone that went into Israel, of which Israel then attacked Syria, I think, cumulatively about 12 times. How is it that the U.S. thinks that Iran's presence is destabilizing the region when many think the opposite, that it is the U.S. presence that is doing that?
Well, I'm not sure the U.S. thinks that at all, but they're certainly letting the Israeli regime think for them. Every lie the United States tells about Iran in respect of where it is in Syria, how it is in Syria, what it wants in Syria, and what it does in Syria is to the letter, the very letter, everything that comes out of the mouths of the war criminal Netanyahu and the war criminal Lieberman and the entire criminal aggressive cabal which has occupied Syria since 1967. So when you have a tail of an American dog being wagged by Tel Aviv, it's a bit rich for them to tell Iran what to do in Syria when Iran is a legal partner. Syria invited them in, and in this sense Russia and Iran have exactly the same legal role in Syria, both as invited guests of the sovereign Syrian Arab Republic. And now it is just funny, if as a partner of Damascus, Iran wanted to build an embassy in Damascus as big as the American embassy in Baghdad, which was built without the consent of any Iraqi, the Iranians would of course be allowed to do so. It's also a bit strange that the man on the opposite side of the screen, who apparently is going to single-handedly rewrite the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916, God help us all, but he doesn't seem to realize it's not the Iranians who are occupying parts of Syria with oil, because the Iranians aren't an occupying power at all. But there is one occupying power who is occupying the oil fields along with the Kurdish terrorist proxies, and this is the United States. Fool and his oil will eventually go separate ways, but Syria is suffering greatly in the meantime.
Frederick Peterson, go ahead.
Yes, sir. Well, there would be far less a problem here. In fact, the interests of all people would be much better achieved if the regime of Assad were not so predatory upon his own people. I put his own people in quotes because we have said this country is an amalgam of disparate ethnicities and parts, and there is aggression going on that is beyond human toleration. And the United States, largely, one of the reasons why we are there is for humanitarian reasons, to preserve and protect humanitarianism within the region, not to support a tyrant in oppressing ethnicities within and under his regime. So I suggest that we could go back once again to our history books and find out whether or not this is true. Is this a regime where disparate parts have been preyed upon by authority? The answer is yes. Is this a regime that has inherent natural wealth that is the envy of neighbors? And does it occupy key critical terrain for the transshipment of wealth within the region? The answer is yes to all of those.
Okay, can I have Adam
Gary
respond to it?
Are there common interests with the government? Yes, sir.
Adam Gary, go ahead.
Well, if he was talking about Bahrain, where a vast majority of Shias are being discriminated and shot at with shotguns and tear gas right now, then it would be an accurate statement. But in the Syrian Arab Republic, you have an army, the Syrian Arab Army, and the vast majority are Sunnis. This is not about Alawite or Sunni. This, again, is propaganda designed to divide the Arab world and turn brother against brother, when the very creed, ideology, and political ethos of the Syrian Arab Republic is about Arab unity. And the reason that the United States doesn't like that is because, when taken in totality, an Arab world that is united under a single God, whether Muslim, Christian, whether Maronite or Orthodox, Sunni or Shia, a single language, a single historic geographical space, is occupied only in one part, and that is in Palestine, and also, of course, part of Syria. And the Americans, who are doing the bidding of the Zionist regime in the region, don't want people to realize what Syria is really about. If President al-Assad wasn't supported by a vast majority of his country, he would fail. He's not bribing people with gold for loyalty. He doesn't have any gold left to do so. He isn't bribing them with oil because, of course, the Americans have already stolen that. The reason that Syria is winning the war, and the reason that even before Russia with its might came in was standing firm, is because a majority of Syrians do support a secular, tolerant, pluralistic government that says we must unite against common enemies, and that the Christian over there isn't the enemy of the Muslim over there, as the United States and Israel would like it to be. If not for the support of the Syrian people, the president of Syria wouldn't be there. But he's standing taller than ever, because he's not only a heroic man, but he's a war hero too.
Frederick Peterson.
Yes. Now, I'm supposed to join you in saying the United States is there to encourage the oppression of a Christian minority, and that here's a flash for you. The Kurds are not Arabs. They are integral parts of Syria. They are not Arabs. So to paint all with one brush that conveniently matches the color that you're trying to suggest is simply not accurate. And I don't know how we got to Bahrain. I mean, we can flip around the world and choose other countries to discuss if you'd like, but we're talking about Syria right now.
No, the U.S. never discusses Bahrain.
And I
the
would
US
say
never discusses
the
Bahrain.
The last comment that was made is one with which I quite concur, that there should be respect, protection, and integration of minorities and of different beliefs within the central government. And is that central regime all bad or all evil? No, I do not believe that it is. However, what we're not really talking about the good things that are done or the compromises that have to be made in order to achieve a peaceful, prosperous, forward-reaching and upward-reaching state. We're talking about oppression and ruthlessness that should not be a part of a regime.
Okay.
Even if you point to the, yes, sir. Okay.
Yes. I'd like to focus on why this war is continuing, Adam Gary, and maybe a simple question that perhaps you can fill us in on is, who's fighting who in Syria? As to now paint the landscape for us of who the fighters are, who's fighting against them, who's fighting against the government, and more importantly, who's supporting some of these, well, terrorists, for lack of a better word. Adam Gary.
Well, there are several Takfiri groups which fly under different flags, but all have the same goal. They want to destroy the Syrian Arab Republic and replace it with a Takfiri-style government that would drag Syria down into the depths of hell. Some of the most famously known names for such groups are Al-Qaeda / Al-Nusra, Daesh, and various elements of the FSA. These groups are funded by a disparate, wide-ranging groups of countries, ranging from the Gulfi monarchies monarchies like Saudi Arabia to the United States itself, with covert and sometimes not so covert help from the Zionist entity. Then there are the Kurdish militants, YPG, PKK. These groups pose a threat to the territorial integrity and sovereignty of both the Syrian Arab Republic as well as the Republic of Turkey. These groups are supported entirely by the United States, even as the United States often lies about the amount of support they are giving them. Turkey, of course, has its own pseudo-Takfiri proxies, let's call them, but in the spirit of cooperation, which slowly but surely has grown out of the Astana peace process, which sees Iran, Russia, and Turkey cooperating, Turkey has shifted from trying to promote Takfiri groups in places like Idlib to its Operation Olive Branch, which is directed against the YPG PKK in northern areas of Syria along the Turkish border. In terms of states that are openly hostile to Syria, that would be the state occupying the east of Syria, where the oil is, the United States, and the state, well, pseudo-fake state, that occupies the southwestern part of Syria, and that is, of course, the Zionist entity. Uh-huh. So Syria is diagonally bookended by two occupier regimes which still want to destroy the Syrian government in spite of the fact that that isn't going to happen. So they're going to try to weaken the country through bifurcation and balkanization.
Now, you're talking about the U.S. here, Fredrik Peterson, of the area that they are in, and it is said that on numerous occasions, it is said that the U.S. is supporting terrorists. Now, what that translates into is that the U.S. is supporting elements within the so-called FSA that are terrorists. And Russia actually came out and said that the U.S. base in an area by the name of Al-Tanf, that is an area that has become a black hole where these terrorists operate unhindered. Why is the U.S. therefore not attacking the terrorists the way that it should? An accusation that has been leveled against the U.S. quite often.
Well, the U.S., I should note in preface, is quite committed and very active in fighting ISIS and terrorists throughout the world. However, I should say, in looking at the sides, I am not trying to paint one side as all pure and holy and another side as being all evil. I am saying that there is good and bad on both sides, and often one side's freedom fighter is the other side's terrorist. And yet, if we try to step back from this and look at the behaviors on the battlefield that are tolerated and encouraged, we will find that the preponderant majority and precedent of the terror of the ruthlessness has come from the current regime and also by the supporters of the current regime that have goals not only to, not at all, I should say, to preserve, protect, and defend the better interests and the upward reach of the people, but rather to secure a regional hegemony and a free flow for their own benefit of the resources of that region to the enhancement not of Syria, in fact, at all, but of their own reach for hegemony. So I would say that the United States is there supporting one side. The United States has deployed forces throughout the world in opposition to terrorism that threatens all sides or both sides, and yet the United States is not absolutely pure in this.
Okay, well, let's talk about how it's not pure in
the
this.
Current government.
Adam Gary,
we're looking for
says,
a balance.
Our guest there says that Russia is there, and well, he said that the allies of the Syrian government, I'm guessing it's Russia and of course Iran, are there to have hegemony over the area. Do you agree with that? And secondly, what is the U.S. doing in Syria? At this point, who is the U.S. supporting? What are its goals? Because that's always been static somewhat as to what they are achieving there.
Well, far from taking from Syria, Russia and Iran, along with China, which has always supported the legitimate government of the Syrian Arab Republic, are going to give to Syria in the form of massive reconstruction projects after the war. If all goes well, we could actually see the Mediterranean being linked to the Pacific coast off of China via a One Belt, One Road that would flow between China, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and into Syria in a connectivity cooperation initiative that would be to the economic benefit of all involved. That's called the win-win model as defined in the thought of Chinese President Xi Jinping. It's only the idea and the idea of this old-fashioned American thinking, this zero-sum mentality where in order for me to win, someone else has to lose. That's not how the modern countries of the multipolar world operate, and that's certainly not the case with Russia and Iran, which are there to contribute to Syria. When you see Syrians, tears in their eyes, grasping Russian flags and Iranian flags, you know that not only is this an alliance of necessity, but it is one with an emotional and moral component. Far from, oh, some of it's good, some of it's bad, I would say that the conflict in Syria is the most clear-cut battle between good and evil since the Second World War, when the Soviet Union led and won the fight against the fascist menace. Other conflicts in the world aren't so clear-cut. Syria is, of course, one of these rare moments where the stars of good have aligned against the stars of evil. Now, to address the second point of your question, the United States is not there to do any good. They destroyed 90% of Raqqa, as Bashar al-Jafari said just hours ago at the United Nations Security Council. There has been no evidence of them fighting Daesh, but there's plenty of evidence of them using their Kurdish proxies to try to create a statelet, a pro-Zionist statelet on Syrian territory, which threatens Turkey, threatens Iraq, and by extrapolation threatens Iran, which has its own problem with Kurdish terrorism stroke separatism. They're of course there for the oil, and they're there to put a roadblock in the One Belt, One Road connectivity scheme that I spoke of moments ago. Those are the three goals. It has nothing to do with anything positive.
Thank you for that. We're going to end it there. Adam Gary, founder and director of Eurasia Future. Also, thank you, Frederick Peterson, U.S. Congressional Defense Policy Advisor, spoke to us from New York. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate from Mikhail Tavai, entire team of the Capitol Tehran. It's goodbye.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.
The 8,181st meeting of the Security Council is called to order. The provisional agenda for this meeting is the situation in the Middle East. The agenda is adopted. In accordance with Rule 37 of the Council's Provisional Rules of Procedure, I invite the representative of the Syrian Arab Republic to participate in this meeting. It is so decided. In accordance with Rule 39 of the Council's Provisional Rules of Procedure, I invite Mr. Stephen de Mistura, Special Envoy of the Secretary General for Syria, to participate in this meeting. It is so decided. The Security Council will now begin its consideration of Item 2 of the agenda. I now give the floor to Mr. Stephen de Mistura.
Shukran jazilan wa assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Mr. President, members of the Security Council, I have come to New York to convey in person, I could have done it by video as we have done many times, to the Security Council the Secretary General's grave concern at the escalation of violence in Syria, and to urge you to focus on de-escalating the violence and on the political path forward for the full implementation of Security Council Resolution 2254. We have seen a string of dangerous and worrying escalations, including inside the de-escalation zones established by the Astana, Garantos, and outside them. There has been a gradual return to back-and-forth competition over territory in Idlib and in Hama. We have seen heavy and sustained airstrikes across the northwest and in besieged eastern Ghouta, including today. Civilians have been killed on a horrific scale. Reports suggest more than 1,000 civilians in the first week of February alone. And strikes have continued to hit hospitals, schools, and markets. There have been several allegations of chlorine attacks in Ghouta, in Idlib, and also now recently in Afrin. While we cannot independently verify these allegations, but if confirmed, it is outrageous and should be having no impunity. 320,000 people have been displaced due to fighting in Idlib in just 2 months, an area that is already hosting over 1.2 million IDPs. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is basically al-Nusra, is active in Idlib. Meanwhile, we have reports of heavy mortar shelling falling across even residential Damascus, wounding and killing civilians and damaging infrastructures, embassies, and even close to the hotel where we are. The conflict is also further spilling over Syria's border in more than one direction, and there have been increased military intervention from multiple sources. The last several weeks have seen a new cross-border conflict in Afrin, with yet no clear end in sight. There are reports of exchanges of fire between Turkish and Syrian government forces in Idlib and between the US-led coalition and pro-Syrian government forces in Euphrates Valley, with loss of life. We've seen a Russian aircraft shot down over northern Syria with the loss of its own pilot. And now, over the last weekend, there have been Israeli reports of an Iranian drone entering Israeli airspace. These reports have been denied by Iran. Israeli jets striking targets inside Syria. Israeli jet shot down by Syrian government anti-aircraft fire. And what Israel calls large-scale strikes against a Syrian aerial defense system and Iranian targets. In short, we see developments that raise questions as to the sustainability even of the Astana de-escalation arrangements, in which we had a lot of hope, and we still continue having hope, and threaten wider regional stability. I've been now 4 years special envoy. This is as violent and worrying and dangerous a moment as any that I've seen in my time of tenure so far. Therefore, I strongly reiterate the appeal of the Secretary General to all concerned in Syria and the region and beyond to de-escalate immediately and unconditionally, and urge all stakeholders, including the Astana guarantors, to use their influence to help reduce violence. I also urge continued attention to maintaining the Amman de-escalation arrangements in place in the south. Mr. President, not only are Syrian civilians being killed and displaced in large numbers, more than before, they are also being deprived of the humanitarian assistance they need. There has not been a single UN humanitarian convoy to any besieged area since the 28th of November, 2.5 months. Last week, together with senior advisor Jan Egeland, I warned the humanitarian task force of the International Syria Support Group in Geneva of a collective failure to enable effective humanitarian action. I urged at that time the two co-chairs, the Russian Federation and the United States, as well as other states, to promote urgent action to ensure immediate and unfettered humanitarian access to besieged and hard-to-reach areas in particular. A series of urgent consultations are actually underway in Geneva while we are talking. So far, however, without concrete results, except one convoy, which I referred to. We urgently need genuine de-escalation to protect civilians, evacuate the sick and the wounded, particularly children sick, and allow humanitarian aid to reach the 390,000 people in besieged areas. and those who are also in the hard-to-reach areas. We just learned a few minutes ago, actually, before coming here, that 7,200 people in besieged Ashabia received a partial delivery today, this morning. This is fine. But think about it. That is less than 2% of the 390,000 people which have been and are still in besieged areas. We need much more and much more sustained. We must also never forget, because that's what the people in Syria tell us, the need for concrete steps on the release of detainees and abductees and for the disclosure at least of information regarding persons missing in Syria since March 2011. The UN will leave no stone unturned to press this issue in accordance with Resolution 2254. We also remind the Astana guarantors of their own commitment agreed last December to form a working group, and we urge them to move ahead on this important issue when they meet next. Mr. President, what we are seeing in Syria today not only imperils the de-escalation arrangements and regional stability, it also undermines the efforts for a political solution. Yet, we will not be deterred from pursuing the Geneva process, which is the only sustainable path towards a political solution, and which is mandated by yourself, by this Council. You will recall that in December, when I briefed you, I laid out a number of parameters and observations regarding baskets 2 and 3 of the agenda of the political process, which means the constitutional and electoral baskets. Then on January 25 and 26, I convened a special round 9 meeting of the intra-Syrian talks in Vienna, focused specifically on the constitutional basket. After intensive consultations with the Syrian parties and key states, I made a statement regarding any constitutional committee to be formed and stressed that final agreement on the composition, mandate, and terms of reference of a constitutional committee would need to be reached in Geneva. For its part, the Russian Federation, which had invited the Secretary General also on behalf of Turkey and Iran to a Congress of National Dialogue in Sochi, affirmed that the outcome of Sochi would be brought to Geneva as a contribution to the UN-led intra-Syrian talks in accordance with the Resolution 2254. There were intensive consultations between the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the Secretary General and myself regarding such a understanding. I also maintained on that occasion in Vienna and beyond close consultation with a number of other states at the time. Accordingly, the Secretary General asked me to attend Sochi. The Congress took place over one day on 30 of January. I attended the opening address by Foreign Minister Lavrov, as did the senior representative of Turkey, Iran, and others. Afterwards, all internationals left the gathering to enable the discussion to proceed among Syrians. Only Russian presidential envoy Lavrentiev remained in the room as host to facilitate the debate, and he did so very effectively. Alongside with senior Syrian figures and a presidium of Syrians. I was later officially informed by the hosts that the final statement had been adopted and was made aware of its content. You can see it published on the website of the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Arabic, Russian, and English. As Foreign Minister Lavrov publicly confirmed yesterday after his meeting in Moscow with the Belgian Foreign Minister. As Secretary General has publicly noted, final statement embraced a vision of the future of Syria for all Syrians, as reflected in the 12 living intra-Syrian essential principles that came out of the UN-led talks in Geneva in November last year. The final statement which took place in Sochi, affirmed that a constitution committee should be formed and stated that it should at the very least comprise of government, opposition representatives in the intra-Syrian talks, which means those which are facilitated by the UN in Geneva, Syrian experts, civil society, independents, tribal leaders, and women. The final statement noted that care should be taken to ensure adequate representation of Syria's ethnic and religious components. And it made clear that final agreement on the mandate, terms of reference, powers, rules of procedure, and selection criteria for the composition of the Constitutional Committee is to be reached in Geneva and appeal for the UN in Geneva assistance in that regard. Given this important final statement, I join the closing of the Congress to welcome it and to affirm the UN's intention to proceed speedily accordingly, so as to assist in finalizing all aspects of a constitutional committee, thereby enabling its establishment in Geneva. And I noted to the Congress publicly, as a note to you, that the mandate given by this Council to the UN in Geneva is indeed to set, in the context of Resolution 2254, a schedule and process for drafting a new constitution. We've been assured by the Russian Federation that it will endeavor to ensure that the government of Syria fully supports the official outcome of the Sochi Congress, at which many Syrian government officials were present. I also take note that the Syrian Negotiating Commission, that is the opposition embracing all components specifically mentioned by name in Resolution 2254, has issued a public statement by and large positive towards moving ahead on a constitutional committee under the auspices of the UN in Geneva. Mr. President, since the Vienna and Sochi meetings, both of them important, I've been consulting intensively on the establishment of a constitutional committee. I've had initial discussions so far in Geneva with representatives of the government of Syria, Syrian Negotiating Commission, and with a number of governments. My team continues to be in touch with a wide array of Syrians, women and men, and I continue to look carefully at the candidates for a constitutional committee developed in Sochi and other relevant inputs. I also continue to pursue the convening, naturally, of the further formal intra-Syrian talks and advancing on all the four baskets of the political process in Geneva in accordance with Resolution 2254. I'm particularly aware of the need to focus now more than ever on the establishment of a secure, calm, neutral environment if any constitutional process is to unfold and if UN-supervised presidential and parliamentary elections pursuant to a new constitution as envisaged in Resolution 2254 are to take place. I'm proceeding from here to Munich, God willing, where I will be consulting the Secretary-General and engage in a number of ministers and other senior officials present for the Munich Security Conference. Here is, therefore, Mr. President, the bottom line of my intervention. I intend to strike while the iron is hot and try to move the Geneva process ahead in consultation with all concerned. To do this, I need all the members of this Council, indeed the Council as a whole, and all who have influence on the Syrian parties, including the Astana guarantors and others, to push hard on three main points. First, to work urgently for de-escalation, civilian protection, and humanitarian access. Second, to support the UN in Geneva to give effect in Geneva to the Sochi final declaration within the framework of 2254. Third, to support the UN in convening the political process for the full implementation of 2254, in particular advancing real issues in the basket to promote a safe, calm, and neutral environment. Mr. President, the Syrian people and the United Nations need this Security Council support now more than ever. Shukran jazilan.
I thank Mr. Stefan de Mistura for his briefing, and I now give the floor to those council members who wish to make statements. I give the floor to the representative of the United States.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Stefan, for your briefing and for all of your efforts to find a peaceful solution to the conflict in Syria. The United States fully supports your initiative to bring the parties back to Geneva and to start work on a new constitutional committee in accordance with Resolution 2254. But we are not going to get to peace when the situation on the ground continues to escalate with dire risks for the security of the entire region. Earlier this week, Iranian-backed militias in southern Syria launched a drone into Israeli territory. It was an egregious and unprompted escalation. Iran was once again doing what it does, risking conflict and testing the will of its neighbors and opponents to resist its aggression. Israel rightly took action to defend itself. The United States will always stand by our ally when confronted with provocations from Iran, Hezbollah, or the Assad regime. But this incident shines a spotlight on the reality in Syria today. We are seeing actors engage in a dangerous game of pushing boundaries instead of behaving responsibly and committing to peace. Last week, pro-regime forces launched an unprovoked attack against the Syrian Democratic Forces and advisors from the Defeat ISIS coalition. This was a large attack involving numerous tanks, artillery, and fighters. The coalition acted in self-defense to repel the attack, and the United States will always reserve the right to act in self-defense. But this attack shows the recklessness of the pro-regime fighters. Parties on the ground need to adhere to all established de-confliction mechanisms and ensure nothing like this happens ever again. The Assad regime has become a front for Iran, Hezbollah, and their allies to advance the irresponsible and dangerous agenda for the Middle East. On every front of this conflict, we find fighters imported by Iran from Lebanon, Iraq, and Afghanistan. When we see the Assad regime starving civilians in eastern Ghouta or pummeling schools and hospitals in Idlib, we see advisors from Iran and Hezbollah helping direct those atrocities. This support for the Assad regime is not new, of course, but the drone flight this week is a wake-up call for all of us. Iran and Hezbollah are making plans to stay in Syria. When we look out across the Middle East, we know one thing for certain. When Iran and Hezbollah move in, instability always follows. So when we talk about peace in Syria, we need to face the reality of what's happening on the ground. Peace is urgent in Syria. All of us on the council know that. But we can't offer support for peace on the one hand and ignore the fact that the chief sponsor of terrorism in the Middle East and its terrorist militia are digging in. Even as we talk about peace at the UN, the fighting is getting worse. Much of the violence is happening in so-called de-escalation zones. Russia was supposed to guarantee adherence to these de-escalation zones to help the political process. But then again, Russia was also supposed to guarantee that all chemical weapons would be removed from Syria. Instead, we see the Assad regime continue to bomb, starve, and yes, gas civilians. All of us on this council know what it will take to get to peace in Syria. More than 2 years ago, the council unanimously adopted Resolution 2254, which includes a framework for ending this war. The United States is committed to seeing the full implementation of Resolution 2254, which President Trump and President Putin also reaffirmed when they met last November in Vietnam. We also know how peace talks need to happen. There is no doubt that Geneva and the UN-led political process is the sole legitimate venue for coming up with a political solution in Syria. Special Envoy de Mistura has talked about setting up a constitutional committee, and he must be fully empowered to do that. No party should have a veto over the UN's decisions about the composition of the constitutional committee. But it's hard to see how a peace process will work while the Assad regime continues to launch all-out attacks against the Syrian people, and Iran and Hezbollah are entrenching themselves inside the country. Ultimately, we must recognize that the Assad regime does not want peace unless it's peace on their terms, a peace in which every person in Syria who opposes the regime is murdered, tortured, starved, imprisoned, or forced to flee the country. So if the Geneva process is going to work, we need to see a change. As one of Assad's key backers, Russia can change this behavior. Russia can push the regime to commit to seeking a real peace in Syria, a peace that helps the Syrian people, a peace that helps ensure the region's security. Now is the time for Russia to use that leverage. The road to peace will come when all of the parties stop provoking each other and choose the responsible path. The path is clear. Follow Resolution 2254. Support Geneva. And most of all, push the Assad regime to do what it plainly does not want to do. If we rally around these goals, we will achieve real peace in Syria. Thank you.
I thank the representative of the United States, and I give the floor to the representative of the Russian Federation.
Thank you. We are grateful to Mr. de Mistura for his briefing. Stefan, it was very interesting to hear your appraisals about the outcomes of the conference held in Sochi on 29 to 30 January, the Syrian National Dialogue Congress. Your participation on the part of the United Nations lent particular significance to this event. The Congress was a success, and yet another important step was taken towards the restoration of peace and stability in Syria. A genuine opportunity has emerged for revitalization of Syrian peaceful dialogue. For the first time, we managed to bring together in one hall more than 1,500 representatives of the majority of domestic political forces and many external opposition forces. We did not see individual leaders in Sochi who have been established under the influence of a negotiations group, but there were some individuals there in their personal capacity, but the one-third of the representatives were there in their personal capacity. This is unprecedented representation and attests to the understanding by the Security Council that Syrians themselves must take ownership and determine the future of their country without any diktats from abroad and without any intervention from abroad. Participants in the Congress reaffirm their commitment to UN-led dialogue on the basis of Security Council Resolution 2254. A specific outcome and decision was adopted. The final statement contains what has been created by UN with UN mediation, 12 principles for the renewed Syria. The Syrian people reached agreement to establish a constitutional committee with a call for the UN Secretary General to instruct you, Mr. de Mistura, to lend assistance in organization of work to lay the ground for constitutional reform and to ensure definitive agreement by the composition of about the composition of the committee and its remit. We trust that this activity will be done in a transparent manner and that UN mediation would be as optimally effective and will reflect the understanding reached in Sochi as regards Syrian participants. However, one thing is clear, and this is the premise from which we proceed, decisions on all issues around state structure, including the constitutional basket, will be taken by the Syrian people themselves without external pressure and without what is written for them or in their stead, any principles or projects or plans. Furthermore, during the Congress, what was approved was the Syrian call for the international community to help in surmounting the crisis and in rebuilding the economy. the Russian Federation will continue to support inter-Syrian talks in Geneva. We regret the position of some countries who are talking members of the Syrian opposition out of visiting Sochi. And now this small group continues to engage in deconstructive activities, preempting the outcomes of Geneva discussions on the future political discussion in Syria. This is at odds with Resolution 2254. The sole basis for discussions of the issue of constitutional reform is what has already been mentioned, namely the 12 principles, and these were agreed upon by the Syrian people in Geneva. They were approved in Sochi, and they were enshrined in the final statement emanating from the Congress. Today, we are circulating this as an official Security Council document. Amongst these principles, what remains key is respect for the sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity of Syria, non-intervention in its domestic affairs, the right of the Syrian people independently to determine their future. We will not conceal the fact that we are troubled by the disrespect by some international and regional players vis-a-vis matters of Syrian sovereignty. Of late, what we have observed are alarming occurrences. It is important to understand that this does not foster normalization of the situation in Syria or the region on the whole. It fans the flames of conflict, and it makes prospects for Syrian settlement all the more remote. At the same time, there are passions about the Syrian dimension of the dossier, which has become particularly telling during the successful conduct of the Congress in Sochi. As usual, this is a powerful disinformation or misinformation campaign, and today the U.S. Delegate talked to us about new unfounded allegations against Syria and the Russian Federation. The Russian Federation is constantly being demanded, something is constantly being demanded of the Russian Federation. However, we will not demand anything, but we would request that our U.S. partners and our other partners under the coalition who have influence to bear on members of the opposition, for them to exert their influence so as to ensure that they too cease hostilities and refrain from provocations and further outbreaks of violence. Incidentally, we have another assessment. Our assessment differs about the incident which occurred in eastern Syria between coalition forces and the pro-government forces. This was not a provoked attack. This was an unprovoked attack. We have already mentioned this during consultations. The humanitarian situation in Syria has various natures, and it originates in various areas. And the reasons for each differ, and each needs to be subject to a specific, unique approach. I'm not even talking now about the baseless allegations of Damascus having used chemical weapons. I wish not to think that there are forces who continue to seek to torpedo the political process in order to achieve their dubious geopolitical aims and advantages. And I think that Mr. de Mistura will concur with us that today the Syrian people and the UN mediators need to require robust, concerted support. Backsliding would have grave repercussions. Thank you.
I thank the representative of the Russian Federation.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.